Hey, this is Zach.
And I'm Clint, and we wanted to thank ExoTerra for sponsoring this episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio.
ExoTerra is the industry leader in glass terrarium enclosures, and we are a big fan of getting to see the species we work with both at home and at the university.
We utilize ExoTerra caging here at Metazotics, and in addition to top quality terrariums, ExoTerra offers an array of heating options, lighting, supplements, decor, and truthfully, anything needed or wanted when keeping reptiles.
Thank you, ExoTerra, for supporting Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. Hello all, welcome to yet another episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. I believe we're on episode 52. As always, Clint is here with me. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, my man. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm hanging in. I've got 10 more days to the semester, and all I have to do is research and fun stuff for the summer, so I can make it to the end. I'm preaching to all the students right now, like, we can do it. Let's get to the end. And some of them, I don't know if they're going to make it. But I think I'm going to, so, you know, there's that. So, yeah, that's where I am the last 2 weeks for anybody in higher ed that teaches is rough. But then I can honestly say that when I became the department chair, things became exponentially worse because it's my job to keep everybody motivated to get to the end when all I want to do is collapse in a pile of protoplasmic goop. But, yeah, no, I'm good. So tonight our guest is – I'm excited for this one. Our guest tonight is Mike Clarkson. Mike Clarkson, many of you may know him, especially those of our listeners that love aquatic snakes. So Mike keeps a lot of homolopsids. He keeps acrocordis, and he's going to be – I'm just really looking forward to this interview because those of you that know anything about me know my favorite group of snakes are all aquatic snakes. False water cobras, great big giant dipsadids that are – aquatic and live in swamps. So we brought Mike on to talk about that. And we also brought Mike on because he's the president of IHS, the International Herpetological Symposium or Society. And he will be talking to us about the upcoming meeting, of which myself and Roy Blodgett put together an advancing herpetoculture session, which I know our listeners are interested in because when I pitched it in the fall, I only got about 25 to 30 DMs within like 48 hours of the episode landing. So a lot of updates on that. And we'll be talking with Mike here in about 20, 25 minutes. But before we get to that, we have our housekeeping. So my collection right now is in full blown ovulation mode. Females are swelling. And I also have my first clutch on the ground, which is kind of insane. The first clutch of false water cobras hit on Sunday. So I got 33 eggs out of one of my females. And the goofy thing is I was just calling Clint this week to say, hey, Clint, I've got a bunch of false water cobra babies that I got to move because I also have research projects that last year's babies are now going to be up for grabs within the next 2 weeks because those studies are coming to an end. And that's when we move our young. So false water cobras, man, if you're interested in them, hit me up, hit Clint up, hit us up. We got them.
Make sure you get them.
Yeah. And I will say that these animals that are ready to move, they're really nice because they are well past the dumb baby phase. Some of them are pushing like 3 feet in length. Some of them are over 3 feet. I went up to the study. We have a dedicated room for this project. And I was looking at them with the grad student whose project it is. And I was like, yeah, the project needs to end and these need to go to like their forever homes. So, you're interested.
Some high blacks and hypos, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. High yellow, really pretty. They're from my high black line and they're from my, hypo line. And if you're listening, I've got some sad news. The high blacks, my line of high blacks it's not in any danger. I kept holdbacks, but, my original female, that produced all the high blacks. She passed away on Sunday. Oh, so, no. Yeah, she was an old snake. It, it you know, it bummed me out though. We all have like that one snake in our career that we, you know, that's like our favorite. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. this was that animal. Like, I was in a funk for about 2.5 days. I'm just now kind of getting out of it. So I don't know if I'm going to be producing any more high blacks for a little while because the holdbacks are growing up. And I know that I am now keeping quite a few of these because of that. But if you're interested in those, hit me up on that. My other update I'll give during the science update, because the paper that I'm going to talk about is actually one that was published from my lab. So nice. More on that in a bit. That makes it easy because I actually know the study very well. What is your update there, Clint, with the market and things at Metazotics and all that jazz?
Okay, man. This is one of those episodes I've had to come with a notepad in front of me because of so much that we've got going on and to update about, not just from Metazotic standpoint, but just from a CCR standpoint, you know, really. We've got some exciting things to talk about. So from the shop, things are going fantastic. And, you know, you're talking a moment ago about kind of looking at that summer break and when you just get to do research and that type of thing. And, you know, my wife is a department chair for the largest high school here in town. And she's a department chair for the special education department. And I mean, the amount of extra work that goes into
that. She's doing the Lord's work.
Yes. And
my parents were special education teachers. I know about IEPs and
yes,
all that.
Yes, I hear all about the elemental P's. You know, it's hear about that all day. So, you know, it's, you know, and I hear her and I know she's kind of counting down the days sometime until that break. And I get to thinking that, and I've told her, I said, you know, I don't have that target date for anything. I've just accepted that I am in a perpetual state of tired. You know, that's just who I am now. And I don't know if it's because of, you know, the business being over 40, but I wake up tired. I go to bed tired. It's who I am. But as far as around the shop, like I said, things are going really, really well in a lot of ways. This was the time where when I mapped out our trends from last year, I expected us to have, you know, some dips that we were hitting. And we had a slight one, which still was a lot better than last year, 1 week. Otherwise, the weeks continued. I mean, just to run really high compared to what I was anticipating, which was good because it allowed me to do a lot of other things as far as move projects faster, because there are certain funds that I'm like, okay, well, we want to be tighter now. No, I've been able to invest in it. But like you said, I've got gravid females all over the place. It's funny because I can't remember if I said this the last episode or not, but we mark all gravid females with a certain color code of like hanging tag. And now you walk into those rooms and there's just, they're everywhere. And it's funny because me and Steve, who works back in the breeder rooms, it's kind of while we know things are going to get super busy once all these babies are here, and that's going to be Drew's, you know, Drew will be super busy. For us, every Friday, I have to go into all these rooms and pair everything that, you know, we don't cohab together. And I have to have my charts, my list to, you know, what females go into what male now. And I also look, okay, does the male have the little blue fingernail polish that I put on? If not, I have to mark those. And so it takes me several hours just to pair all this stuff. Well, then come Monday, Steve has to unpair all this stuff before he, you know, gets to cleaning and start feeding and all that. And the good thing is, once they're gravid, neither one of us have to do that with that female anymore. So it really speeds us up and starts, you know, giving us a break. But I've got some black rat snake morph eggs already in the incubator. Corn snakes have started to hit. Every day, I mean, we go back there and there can be something. I think we're probably somewhere around 40, 45 gravid females. I say gravid, meaning you're about to bust gravid.
Yeah.
There's several others that I'm like, I'm pretty sure, you know, but I'll check you again in a few days and that'll tell me. Some gravid gray bands. I've seen the black milk starting to lock. I've started pairing sub ox now. We'll see how that's an ongoing struggle with them. So we'll see how they do. but we have baby Beardy starting to hatch now. And so hatching season's already began, you know, here.
Nice.
So lots of good stuff there. I'm starting to look at some cool caging that would be, I've already got great caging for, you know, the big stuff, but we're talking like arachnid type caging, stuff like that. That would be a Metazotics line. So that's exciting. But like I said, things have continued to move at a rapid pace. I did just have the last show, this past Sunday in Lexington. And so now I'm show free until June. So I've got a month, you know.
Ah, you're breathing now.
Yes. So that was, I guess that was the one date I was looking at but it's good because it gives us this month to prep for everything that's coming, you know, down the pipeline still. So that's cool. One update that I want to give to everyone, and this is an update really that's from Zach and I, because it does open the door for some other cool things. We officially now have CCR Media. And what that is basically the podcast is officially recognized as an LLC. And the reason that that does come into play is because we needed some things like that put in so that we can open the, you know, conservation funds, so we can do things from more of a legal standpoint, in addition to be able to create the Patreon and things like that. So the fact that it's, you know, we officially got that in play now means that we can begin moving forward with a lot of other ideas and things that we've got. So that's exciting. Got that in. What else do we have here? Do we want to jump into the market update, or do you want to take science first?
You can do the market update.
Okay, let's do the market update. We've got several things here for me to go into. As always, the market update is brought to you by the Show Me Reptile Shows. We appreciate Show Me being a sponsor and supporter of Colubrin and Clubroid Radio. Upcoming shows for Show Me, we've got April 27th, Murfreesboro. April 28th, there's North Kingstown, as well as Davenport. May 4th is Jacksonville. May 19th, Show Me has a show in Warwick, Rhode Island, Janesville, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri, all on the same days. And then May 25th in Gadsden. So good stuff coming from Show Me. Let's see, we've got numbers. Let's talk numbers for a second, and then I will go into a little bit more detail. So some market change, of course. These numbers are pulled off Morph Market. You know what? I'm going to have to go on a tangent, and Zach, I'm sure you'll know where this came from. Mm-hmm. So these numbers, okay? These numbers are coming from one source, okay? And they can be interpreted however an individual wants to interpret these trends. As is any set of data points, they will become more and more valuable the longer they're tracked, because then you're able to see historical trends, especially year over year. Right now, we're getting to look more like month over month, quarter over quarter, that kind of thing. So far, they have followed the predictions that we've laid out with timelines. But two things I'd like to point out, I guess. One, these numbers are from one source and one source only. However, what we discuss here on the show are coming from multiple sources. The numbers are from one, but then we also discuss shows. We discuss the attendance at shows. These are coming from the show promoters as well as what the vendors are seeing. You're getting observations from myself via the shop that I'm sitting in right now and the trends that I see there. But the interpretation of all of this data, while yes, it's coming from someone in the hobby, myself, it's also coming from an individual with 20 years of multi-unit management background in which what I was paid to do was to analyze numbers, view trends, predict what was going to happen, and make business decisions based off of these trends. Yes, this is coming from a certain poke You know, let's say, you know, the bear was poked.
Yep.
And while I think it was rather humorous, we were going to go ahead and say that because we have the platform and we're allowed to do this kind of thing sometimes. I think I told Zach, I'm allowed my moment of petty.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right. Back to the numbers, everyone. So, in the last 2 weeks, we saw ball pythons on Morph Market drop 1,231. And it's currently listed. They are under 37,000 ball pythons listed, which is the lowest it's been since I've ever looked at Morph Market. And that was a 1,231 drop, 3.2% from 2 weeks ago. All other pythons, let's see, they actually, this is the first time I've witnessed this. The other python categories increased by five pythons from 2 weeks ago. So a 0.2% increase. That was an anomaly. You know, I don't know if we're starting to see some things hatch and added in. Well, obviously we had some things added in, and I guess it outpaced what was sold. So that was interesting. Another idea, and this just hit me. I think I saw it hit you actually. Yeah. This is complete speculation because I would have double checked this to see, but I wonder if there were some large import shipments that came in.
Not sure.
I wonder if that could have been some of the offset on why we saw that number increase, but when nothing else has, because I don't really expect all of these python species to really be hatching yet right now. So I wonder if that was it. And I could go back and look to see, you know, if I see an increase in import labels, you know, in those. But just a thought there for everyone. Boas dropped 185 snakes, so down 3.9%. Colubrids, 255 snakes, down 4.9%. So once again, colubrids were the biggest mover in the two-week time frame. Which again, I like seeing that. Overall, the markets came back in line because, as you remember, we were typically seeing about a 3%, no more than 4% change. But then last week we saw 2 weeks ago, we saw 6.6. So this big jump. We were at 3.3% overall market change, which again stays in line. As far as colubrids, we have horned snakes making up 22.2%. They dropped 8.4% in their total numbers. 120 corn snakes moved in the last couple weeks.
Damn.
Hognose are making up 30.4% of the colubrid market list there. They dropped 54, so 2.9%. And all other colubrids are making up 32.1%, and they dropped 81 animals, so down 4.1%. So all in, continuing to see that trend. I still say that we're probably looking towards the end of May to middle of June before we start seeing a lot of these numbers increase with hatchlings starting to become available. And the final breakdown on the numbers here, as of right now, ball pythons are making up 76% of the morph market listings. Other pythons, 4%, boas, 10%, colubrids, 10% right now.
Oh.
So good stuff. I've got the graphs that were posted on the Facebook page previously. For those of you that did not see that, this week I will post, once the episode is out, I'll post these three graphs again. They don't tell a whole lot at the moment, but over time we'll be able to continue to map these out. And because right now it's just showing the trend where it's consistently going down, and we'll be able to see where these pop up when there's more animals available. So
cool.
There's the update with the market. A couple other quick pieces for us. The Colubrid Fest.
Yes.
Update. I know everybody always wants an update. And I have a negative update, but it validates why we aren't putting more out there. So the venue that we were after has fallen through. Finally, upper management has come back and told us that they won't allow reptiles in the building. This is something that does happen. Luckily, Mickey is already on a second venue and seeing if we can get approval there in the same city that we're already looking at. And I have some great listeners and some great friends that have reached out, and I know that some are looking for the city because they'd like to book travel. They'd like to book hotels. The reason we don't want to put this out there yet is we don't want you to do that yet, because that city may completely fall through.
Yeah.
We have to go somewhere else. So that's why some of this is still being held close to the chest. And one thing I guess I'd like to mention, because I know it's probably driving everybody nuts that we talk about this but don't share everything. Know that we are sharing so much more than ever gets shared about a show or an event like this prior to it being locked in. And what I mean by that is typically if there's, you know, some kind of a symposium or a conference, it is already on the books before it's ever announced. If there's a show, it's already on the books before it's ever announced. So that's why you don't see or hear about these things falling through and all the hoops and you know, pieces that don't come to fruition, because it's already laid out before it's ever shared with the audience. The reason this was shared with you guys beforehand is because it was a brainchild of us as well as the audience. You know, this was something that kind of was a ground roots thing that came about. And so that's why I just wanted to update you, and we will continue to update you every other week, you know, or as new information comes about. So,
yeah. And I want to thank everybody that reached out. I still would like for you to reach out about talks, about what you want to hear about. I can say that I had probably 15-20 people message me, and I'm so happy that they did, because my nerd bucket, ivory tower, academic brain had one vision of what the talks were going to be. And then when the listeners reached out, your talks were far more interesting than the ones I had. And I was like, God damn, that's a good topic. So, yes. Like somebody was, you know, what if we did a workshop on different scenting techniques, different live prey, different prey presentation, how to get the babies to eat? Cause you guys always bring that up. And I just sat here in my office at work reading that DM, like, why the hell did you think about that? That's excellent. So please keep that stuff coming. And I can second, I'm a little bit neurotic. Clint has had to calm my ass down at least 4 or 5 times, saying like, we got to let them know where we're doing this. But I also understand why we aren't. So please know, Clint is very zen, and I am a neurotic, coked out. I don't know what the hell, but
well, you know, what's funny?
We will be divulging. Trust me, the second we can, and then I will start sleeping again. So
you know, it's funny. I think that because there's 3 of us involved in this, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's each of us are at this completely different level. It's, yeah. You know, like you said, you know, with Zach, he's very, you know, where are we? We got to say something. You know, we got to make sure everybody knows. And then I feel that I'm somewhere in the middle, because at the same time, I've got Mickey, who, you know, for everyone listening, again, he does this for a living. This is what the man does every day, and he's been doing it for years now. And so, like, when that venue fell through, my instant message to him was, you know, so I, you know, what do we have going on with the second one? And, you know, because again, I'm like, you know I'm going to need to send an update. You know, Zach, we had just had the conversation where you're like, I really want to say the city, you know. And Mickey's response was, patience, grasshopper. And I'm just like, that's the 3, you know, levels mm-hmm. that we're at right now. Yeah. So, but it continues to move in the right direction.
Okay. Well, I'm going to knock science out update out real quick so we can get on with our guest.
Do that. And I want to talk about Terra Sky.
There we go. Perfect.
Because chat about that.
So Science Update is a paper that my applied herpetology and herpetoculture lab put out. My former graduate student, Erin Allison, we just published her thesis in a journal called PLOS One, which means that everybody listening to this can find the article. It's open access. It's not behind a paywall. And I will let you read the article. I just want to talk a little bit about how this came to be, because it's a great example of how science happens. And I think a lot of times it's like kind of over-romanticized like people think that I'm sitting there like in a library reading books, pontificating, and you know, and that's not at all how this happens. So Aaron came to my lab to do crayfish work, and I had a grant to do an education outreach thing with the two endangered crayfish that are in Southern West Virginia, because I wanted to get the word out to the people in Southern West Virginia that, like, you know, this crayfish is special. It's endemic. You only find it here in West Virginia. And anybody that knows anybody from West Virginia, and I know a lot of people, I've had lots of people say this. There's no state, in my opinion, that has state pride like West Virginia. So if you can get the message out that this thing is from West Virginia because of West Virginia in West Virginia, West Virginians are going to love it. So Aaron came on board to do that. But when you do a thesis with me, you have to have two research chapters. So she wanted another environmental ed type chapter. And so I was kind of thinking about the possibility of doing something with snakes. And I was driving from the campus to a little town called Glendale, which is about 35 minutes from here, to do my – I teach an entomology class. So we were going to go to the airport and catch a bunch of bugs in that class. So in driving, I was listening to another podcast that's fantastic, the So Much Pingle podcast, which is a herping podcast. And the guest was Emily Taylor. And Dr. Taylor, if you don't know who she is like the madam of rattlesnakes. She does a lot of really, really cool stuff with rattlesnakes. She's very personable. She has a similar vibe to me. I'd never met her, but you know, I was listening to the podcast, and when I left the parking lot, she was talking about how it'd be really cool if somebody would study people. We always study rattlesnakes, but nobody studies people. And if we want to get people to care about a rattlesnake, we have to understand people's emotions when it comes to the snakes and how to kind of take that negative and switch it positive. And so I'm driving, and I'm like, you know, by myself in the car, and I'm at one point I was like having a full blown conversation with myself, with Emily, who I don't know, basically like, this is it. This is it. Like, you know, I was real excited. So I got down there. Aaron was in the class. I got out of the class. I'm holding a butterfly net. I've got a backpack on. I marched up to Aaron like a rabid grizzly bear. And I said, you're doing your second chapter on rattlesnakes. And then I ran off into the forest to get to the rest of the undergrads. So for a minute there, she was like, I'm studying rattlesnakes. I don't know rattlesnakes. I don't know if I like rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes. So after, you know, I got the students online with the insects they needed to go catch, I then found Aaron and was like, I'm going to reach out to Emily and I'm going to see if she wants to collaborate with us on this. So I did. And Emily said, yes, I definitely want to collaborate with you on this. This is great. And so kudos to my grad student, Aaron, because there were a lot of meetings between Emily, me, her. We also brought on two people, Melissa Amarello and Jeffrey Smith, who are they are the people that run ASP, Advocates for Snake Preservation, because they do a lot of human rattlesnake interface stuff. And then we brought on a third person, or sorry, not a third person, but a final person who was my postdoc at the time, Zach Graham, Dr. Graham, and I basically said, you're doing all the stats because I can't. So that's how science works. And that happened in the fall of 2019. And so basically what we did is we put out a survey. So we were studying people. We made two videos. One video focused on rattlesnakes are good moms. They take care of their kids. Bet you didn't know that. And then the other video was rattlesnakes eat mice. Mice give you diseases and you die quickly. So we were basically doing something called relational messaging. Moms and kids, and then instrumental. Rattlesnakes are an instrument of keeping you not sick. And then we tested that, and we did that by social media. We put this all over the internet. We had well over 1,000 people respond. First question was, do you like snakes? Do you fear snakes? If you like snakes, we kicked you out of the study, but we, you know, we still have that data. And so we were only looking at people that were afraid of snakes, and we looked at everything. We looked at religion. We looked at generation. We looked at age. We looked at education level. And basically what we found out in a nutshell is that agnostics were without question the most open to change. It is something that we found that was rather interesting. And we also found that boomers, that generation, not being insulting here. They fit in two different groups. They either changed or there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell of them changing. Those were the two options that we saw with them. And then kind of a little bit of hope for the future. We did see that Gen Z, which is kind of the people that are in their 20s currently, they were definitely the most empathetic, open to change. And so it was a really, really interesting, you know, analysis. I'm not going to get into it beyond that. Read the paper. Message me if you've got questions. But I was pretty pleased. It actually got a little bit of traction last week. So Newsweek, you know, they interviewed me about the article. And so there was a little thing that went out on that. But yeah, but this is the first kind of big paper to come out of the Herp Lab here at West Liberty. We've had a couple nice papers that were published through the peer review process, but this was our kind of our first biggie. So, and I love Erin to death. She's now the director of the Florida Keys Bird Center. So kudos to her. So that's the science update. Let's talk about these exoterra lights and get to Mike, because this is pretty cool stuff.
This is pretty neat. So one of the perks of having exoterra as a sponsor for the show, you know, not only were we able to get you taken care of out there, Zach, for the study with the hog nose, with a bunch
forever
of
grateful.
absolutely. A bunch of exoterra terrariums out there. But we got to try out some new products as well. Mm-hmm. The Terra Sky. So they sent Zach and I both Terra Sky. And on the next episode, Zach's going to talk about what they're doing with it out at the university there. But what Terra Sky is, and obviously I'm not going to be able to hit everything, you know, that this thing can do on this episode, but it is a UVB, an LED fixture with the light built in. The UV light is built in. It can be controlled to be able to kind of, let's say, flex up, flex down, meaning you can control the amount of UVB coming out of it. So you can have this same fixture on a Euromastix, or you can put it on a tree frog, and you're just adjusting how much UV is coming out of it. With combining the UVB, UVA, LED, and there's some things with I want to call it bioluminescence, and I know it's not that, but it encourages the plant growth, it encourages breeding, it's so neat. And I'll tell you what we did with it. So first off, we took one and we put it on a pair of green-killed lizards that we have out here, and they already had UV on them. So it's not like they weren't getting what they needed. We shut that UV off, put this on, turned it on, and I kid you not, within 20 seconds, both of them ran over to where that UV was being presented and basked under it immediately. And so I thought that was really neat. Now, fast forward a few days, and we got 10 baby panther chameleons in the shop. Now, real quick, local breeder, captive bred. So stoked about that. Not getting them sent in from an import. Love these little guys. We'd set up. We had a big cage ready for them. We set them up. And same thing. Put 10 of these babies in this large enclosure. The moment I turned on the Terra Sky, it was 5 or 6 of them, went straight up, not only over to it, but got on the screen directly under the light and just soaked it up. You can tell how much they were into this thing.
Yeah.
Cool. And there's going to be a lot of features that aren't even unlocked in this yet. And this is something I don't know really how much of this is shared, but I was talking with the guys from Exoterra when we were out at Tinley, and there are features inside this product that are there, technology that's there in preparation for technology that has not yet been released. I mean, I just think that's really neat. So there's a lot of features and things that are coming. There's also a lot more info that's going to be coming out on this product in the coming weeks as it's launched, because I don't think this is really even launched yet to the public. But it's, again, you're looking at moon cycles that you can do with this. You're looking at seasons, similar to like Luminize. We talked about that before. You're able to program this in a million different ways with the white light, the UVA, the UVB. I'm a fan of it already. I think it's really, really neat. And I'm not just saying that because that's a sponsor, but it's a product that is fun. It's cool. And as we've talked about before on the show, I can't help but get excited when I see that there are these things coming out, these products that are being, you know, invested in by these companies to put out to the public that are going to continue to help us take steps to even more naturalistic keeping than what we currently could have, you know, or currently did before. So it's really neat. And we will talk more about it as time goes on and we get to play more and set up more of these cycles. And because my thing is, it's not just what the product can do. It's I like having time to see how the animals respond to the product when we have it set up the way we want it to, you know, and as we continue to mess with some of these cycles. So very neat.
Excellent stuff.
Yeah. And I look thanks forward again, to ExoTerra. We did.
Yeah.
Thanks again, ExoTerra, for sending those to us.
Yeah. And I can also say thank you for all the vivariums. We're setting up the Heterodon lab next week. And I'm really looking forward to that. And that is an excellent tie-in to introducing our guest. So our guest tonight is Mike Clarkson. Mike Clarkson is currently the president of the International Herpetological Society, one of the founding members of Herpetological Conservation International. I think I said that right.
Yeah, and president. Yep.
And president. Yep. And all around herpetological nerd. This guy's herped all over the planet and talked to quite a few herp societies, especially out west, was recently down in Florida. And the snakes he keeps, it's literally taking, you know, tropical fish keeping, herp keeping, smashing them together, and you've got Mike. Before we talk about that, I'm pumped to talk about IHS. So as the current president of the International Herpetological Society, I would love for you, Symposium, as love for you to tell everybody what IHS is and why herpetoculture people owe, and I'm going to say owe, a bit of gratitude to IHS. Because I think when I learned about this, I was in the dark, but I've learned about it the past couple years. And then I went to the meeting last year and it was like, everybody needs to be coming to this thing. That's basically what I was thinking about. So,
no, absolutely. I think what's interesting to me is IHS was more talked about years prior than it has been lately.
Yes.
So I think it's a good thing to talk about because it used to be a little more in the zeitgeist. Like, we're in the kind of same age range. I just hit 40. It's terrible. And so I think when I say early days, I'm talking like, you know, for me, the early days were the 90s. And in the 90s, I think the 70s were still close enough that IHS still had that meaning. And what that meaning, what I'm getting at is if you go to the original proceedings of what was originally known as the Reptile Symposium on Captive Propagation and Husbandry, which was known as the Symposium for Propagation and Husbandry for the first 8 years. Then they realized, oh, we're at amphibians too. And we are international. And that's when the IHS name started coming into play. But let's rewind just a little bit. The very early days, we're talking 1974. Almost all herpers were one thing. You didn't have, is it field herper or is it keeper? And the two definitions. And you ask why. Why did Clobber, who coined the phrase, leave it for both keepers and collectors? And the reason was every keeper was a collector because that's the only way you had a snake. Like, we didn't have the luxury of captive bred or wild caught. If you wanted to work with hognose snakes, you better go out and catch a hognose snake or trade for someone who caught them. Now, where does this take place? Reptile shows didn't exist yet. I think a lot of people forget that Jurassic Park was a major industrial turning point when we talk about the industry's growth. 1994 saw an explosion. But prior to that, things were starting to heat up. Herp shows already were going. But way back before herp shows, there was no opportunity for keepers who were also herpers to exchange ideas and information. I mean, let's date it even further. The internet didn't exist. You had county libraries.
Oh, no, no, no.
Right.
And unless you're going to be mailing letters to each other, if one person figured out how to breed corn snakes, how does that information get disseminated? Which is where this symposium, those were the founding ideas. Let's share this information. And some of the first talks, which I have right here, the original program for the first IHS, I mean, you look at what they're talking about, and today it sounds so simplistic, but back then this was cutting edge. And we're talking about breeding leopard geckos. We're talking about, you know, notes of hibernation, how to hibernate snakes. I mean, things we wouldn't ever think about. And then after the talks, people would go room to room, which is actually something the Gem and Minerals crowd still does in Tucson during the Gem and Mineral Expo. You'd go room to room and you'd just go, hey, if you want to check out my garter snakes, come to room 274 after the meeting. And people would exchange in the hotel. Now, you could see how this probably wasn't the best setup, and there could have been some incidences. So eventually the board moved to say, hey, no more animal exchanges at IHS. But the very first talks about breeding the very first colubrids and the very first exchanging of hands of animals and the very first exchanging of information of how to breed animals all took place at IHS. Now, fast forward when the board said, okay, the whole animals and hotel things and like cupboards and stuff probably isn't the best path forward. Well, that's when Wayne Hill said, well, then what about a reptile show? And reptile shows were born from IHS changing the rules. But the initial way for people to trade was either you met up, like you hear the old stories of Bob Alvegate driving out to Texas and trading people on like some random road in the middle of nowhere, driving from California to do a snake exchange. Because, you know, there wasn't online classified ads. There wasn't a good way of how do we ship this stuff. So is meetups. And IHS were those first meetups and those first ID exchanges. Now, like any organization, it grew up, it evolved, and it changed. And honestly, I think it changed in many ways for the better. Because where it started as captive propagation, and it was the zoos and academics, you know, there was a need for it. How do these people that are collecting herps and breeding them, how are they doing it? And the zoos wanted to know, and the academics wanted to know, and the hobbyists wanted to share. And this was the first time we really had a meeting place of the hobbyist, the academic, the zookeeper, where you're kind of, I don't want to say you're all in the same field because you're all in different planes of, you know, the hobbyist versus the person doing it for a business versus someone doing it for research. But in this context, we all share a passion. We all have things to exchange. And that mantra, that kind of mindset has continued in IHS where this isn't just an exchange of someone talking about, you know, the monitors they're working with. And last year we had a great presentation on that.
Yes, we did.
And it's not just the zoo saying, hey, this is what we've done in our enclosures. And then you can take it home going, I'm going to do that on my own scale. It's not just that. It's not just the groundbreaking research sometimes we get that it's like, wow, I had no idea. And we're talking very recent publications. It's all of it combined where you as a hobbyist can join in with the zookeepers and join in with the academics and all exchange ideas as peers. And it's really exciting that still exists, that there is a place where hobbyists can get involved in science, involved in conservation. And if you want to, like say you're just like, you know, I really enjoy this, but I'm looking for new ventures and avenues in herping as a whole and herps as a whole. That's the place to go. That's the place you're going to meet senior zookeepers and heads of academic departments, you know, like esteemed people like, you know, Zach, yourself. That's a great place to meet Zach. That's a great place to meet someone like Emily Taylor, who, as you're mentioning her, is like, actually, I just got her book yesterday. It's a great networking opportunity. But unlike the shows, because look, I go to all the shows I can. You know, I'm definitely you'll see me at every Reptile Super Show if I'm in town because that's local to me. And then anytime I get extra time, I'd never miss an NARBC show. I haven't been one of the Show Me shows, but you know, I am a show junkie. I'll admit that, and I'm usually browsing. What I work with is generally not available at the shows. It's just socializing for me. But that is networking on the keeper side. But if you want to extend that portfolio of networking to academics and zoo people and field herpers and just really round it out, you should go to IHS. When I went to my first IHS, and this is kind of funny, it was over my 2-year wedding anniversary, and it was in San Antonio, and I was broke. You know, I got married young. I was 22 going to, and my wife said, you know what, go to IHS, you've always wanted to go. But that's how big a deal it was for me, and that's how big a deal she knew it was for me. Because when I said, hey, I want to go to IHS, me and this friend are going to drive there because neither of us could afford plane tickets, she said, you know what, we could celebrate when you get home because that's a big deal. That was the kind of, you know, gravitas that attending IHS had to me, and it still does. Because, you know, this year, the names we have speaking aren't names you're going to get that mix of anywhere else. Sure, there's a lot of places you can go and hear speakers. And I speak at other events. I speak at fish clubs, reptile societies. I'll speak at other symposiums. But IHS is a unique special event where you get that integration of all different fields of herpetology, herpetoculture, field herping all together at once. And it's, I don't know, for me, that's why it's been the meeting that as much as I can, and summer's a hard time for me to get away. Like immediately after IHS, like the day after, I have to fly overseas. It's not the easy time for me. That's busy season. But it's always been something that I'm very excited to share with people, excited to attend, and now, you know, dauntingly excited to take on the role of president, which, I'll tell you, when they first mentioned it to me, I'm like, is there someone else with my name here? Cool. All right, let's go.
Been there before.
I tell you, you know, with everything you just said, so this particular year is going to be the first year that I will be able to attend, you know, an IHS.
Awesome.
And I'm really stoked and really looking forward to it. And to kind of take a, you know, a spin on something that you'd said just a moment ago, on one of the reasons I'm so looking forward to this. Now, given I'm like the other two guys right here on this episode, I could talk about reptiles for hours. You know, we love this, you know, it's great. You know, and I enjoy reptile shows. There's a nice social aspect there. I like to see what I see. Now, typically, though, at reptile shows, you know, especially over the past couple of years, I'm a vendor. And when vending reptile shows, while I have a good time, it does take a certain piece away from me, because even when I'm having one of those great conversations with someone about a species and, you know, this is happening, my eyes are still having to scan my table. Mm-hmm. I'm still having to turn, you know, when there's another customer or something that's come up, and I have to make sure that I'm working, you know, the way that I need to. Well, what I am looking so forward to on being able to attend IHS is not only getting to listen to all the information that is being shared, but I get to put away everything else and just get to be, you know, in that environment and get to talk without worrying about, you know, the next person that's got a question that I need to make sure I give the right amount of time to, that kind of thing. And just really get to, you know, sit down and be engrossed in herps and in the herp environment of, when I say environment, meaning the environment of people, the herpers, you know, that are there. And that's just, that's going to be so neat to me. I mean, that's not something I really get to spend a lot of time on anymore. So really looking forward to that.
You just nailed it, because last year was my first. And what's really interesting is I'd heard of IHS all the way back in the early 2000s when I was in graduate school to get getting my master's degree in herpetology. And we went to conferences, and that's what you did. And one of the guys in my lab went to whatever IHS it was in 2003. And then around that time is when I made the segue to crayfish and then veered away from herpetology. And then, you know, the zoo side came back 2016. And then it was like I got pushed right back into the kettle of herpetology. And I was desperately trying to find a place to take all these students, because we're doing herpetoculture research, and I'm not like throwing shade or anything towards the other herp meetings, but they're way, way, way more. I don't want to be in any way, shape, or form insulting, because I feel like this could actually be insulting to IHS, and it's not. So let me explain. The other ones are really cerebral. I don't like those kinds of meetings. When I go to a meeting, I want to nerd out, and I want to feel like I am in a safe space. And I want to be with the nerds that are as passionate as me. And I use nerd as a term of endearment. Mm-hmm. All righty. And when I went to IHS, you go to the mixer on whatever the first night, and my first one, I've got two grad students with me. I knew Russ Gurley because we had written the book and it had just come out. I didn't know anybody else. 20 minutes in, and I'm an introvert, okay? You had to pull me away from people. That does not happen with Zach Lofman.
That icebreaker, by the way, always goes so long.
Yeah, and it just kept going and going and going and going, because, you know, I talked to some guy about Barron's racers. I didn't know who he was, but he said, I heard you talking about Barron-I. And I was like, yeah, I talked about, I've kept Barron-I forever. He told me about the first ones that came in when they were, you know, initially imported, the problems that they had initially with Barron-I, how there's so, you know, they're so cool. And here I am. I just published a book on Barron-I. This is a keeper. This guy This is what he's done for the past 30 years. You cannot get that over the internet. You can't. You can't get it over a Facebook group. Can't get it through chats. It was freaking awesome. And it went for the entire time. Like, by the end of it, it felt like nerdy reptile summer camp, and it was coming to an end, and I was 44 years old. I didn't want it to end. And I knew right then and there, I'm going to this meeting every time. They give out awards to up-and-coming herpetologists, the Junior Herpetology Award. I have been to so many scientific awards, or sorry, scientific symposiums in my life. You don't think about, like, that's not part of it. That's part of IHS. So it is a family type atmosphere. But then you also have, last year, they had the freaking curator of the Field Museum come in and talk about museum collections. We had graduate students talking about field work they had done in Southeast Asia with homolopsid snakes. John Murphy gave an awesome talk about all the books he's written. And it was literally like, it was the meeting I was looking for that I didn't know exist. So that's why I thought when I left, A, I'm not going to this meeting ever again. Like, this is going to be a fixation. If I have a herpetoculture lab, we will be at every IHS. And then I thought, we've got to bring the herpetoculture back. And herpetoculture, that sounds like it wasn't there. There were definitely herpetoculture talks. I gave a herpetoculture talk. But this year, you know, given the roots, I just kind of felt like, you know, we all are looking for a place to go that's not a show, but has the kind of fun, nerdy, let's just talk about this. And IHS was that place. So that's why the herpetoculture talks and the advancing herpetoculture session is going on at IHS this year. So,
yeah. And by the way, none of that was at all, from my perspective, insulting. And it was actually spot on. And I actually really appreciate that review. And it means a lot. Because, you know, these symposiums are difficult to put on. There are a lot to coordinate. There's a lot of moving parts. And hearing someone who was like, that was reptile summer camp and I didn't want to go home, that to me is the best review I could hear. But to your point of it being a little cerebral, a little heady, I feel like there is that's the gray space we exist in. Because you have JMIH and you have World Congress, and those are excellent meetings. But if you haven't spent 8 years in uni, there's going to be some of those talks go right over your head, and there's going to be not shade whatsoever. The talks that happen at those things, you can't miss them if that's your field. But if that's not your field, you might feel a little bit like, you know, you stepped up a league that you weren't ready to jump into. And I don't want to say in a not welcoming way, because I'm not saying anything negative. It's just that's that tier. That is the academic tier. And if you are a hobbyist, you might not quite feel like you're quite amongst your peers the same as you could at an IHS, which is a mixed bag. There's also a handful of great hobby-only symposiums that are literally like, this is the gecko symposium. If you are just into geckos, go to the gecko symposium. We're not saying not to go to all of them. Good content is good talk content. Enjoy it, ingest it, find your right spot. What we are saying is IHS is a weird in-between all of those things that hits so many boxes for so many of us. If you're an advanced herpetoculturist, you refer to your animals by their Latin names. You're maybe a little more on the nerd level tier, which yes. I agree. I say that as an endearing thing. IHS might be exactly your sweet spot. If you kind of went to other meetings and go, you know, it wasn't quite enough, but World Congress in Borneo isn't something you're going to, you know, be able to make because it's a bit of a trip. Check out IHS. And I think what you said put it beautifully, where we sit and where we'd like to continue to sit. And mentioning getting back to our roots and the advancing herpetoculture, there was for a few years a lot of people saying, hey, IHS doesn't do herpetoculture. And we always have, but it's always been really mixed in. And, you know, the balance of how many of those are zoo talks and how many of them are just relative keeper talks has changed year to year as the program coordinators change. Obviously, you know, we've gone from Jen Stabile, who was a great president, did great things for the organization from an academic background. Now they're coming to me, who, if I had to pick a category to fall in, because I am obviously an avid field herper, but I'd say hobbyist. You know, I've published a handful of papers, but I'm not an academic. I didn't finish my degree. I sidetracked into TV instead. That's kind of, I guess, the space I fill. And every changing of the guards with IHS, we try to keep rotation of who's in charge and what their background is between zoo, academic, and keeper. And now that I'm kind of this hobby side representation for the organization, that's why we said, hey, advancing herpetoculture, let's put a focus on what's always been there, but we want to put a little extra light on it now. And I hope this becomes a tradition that continues forward, because IHS started as captive propagation, and it's never left, but I do want to reinforce that this is something that we talk about. This is something we take serious. And honestly, it's one of the few topics that transcends all the different people there in terms of interest, because if you're studying Erpaton, but you're studying them on an ecological level in the wild, hearing how they breed has things that correspond to your research. And if you're just a hobbyist, it corresponds. And if you're a zookeeper, you might be, oh, shoot, we have those. That's good information to have. So, yeah, I feel very strongly that herpetoculture is a key part of IHS, and having a set day curated by someone like yourself where it's you're in it. You guys are talking about the market. You're talking about the trends. You're talking about products. I wish I had my finger on the pulse, or my thumb on the pulse, for those of you who get that joke.
What's left of it.
What's left of it, yeah. I wish I had that you guys have. I don't nearly have the bandwidth to track all that anymore. Between HCI, IHS, gig, and then my two herp rooms, I am slammed. But you guys have that. That's why you're the perfect people to be curating this, which is when we were discussing, I was super excited. I'm like, that's great, because you asked me, and I'm like, I like wet snakes.
Well, you know, we were talking even before we started recording, and I think that what is just so beautiful about IHS, and it fits right in with the philosophy that we have here at CCR, and that is, you know, while there's so many things that we've got big ideas and big vision on things we would like to accomplish, the one thing that if we said, if nothing else, at the end of us doing what we do here, if we will have made a difference, we hope that it's we are able to close the gap, or in some way lessen the gap between academia and the keepers. You know, so herpetoculture and herpetology, let's call it like that. And that is so much of what I think we push forward, and to have this organization and this event that shares that mindset and is actively doing the same kinds of things. That's fantastic. I mean, it's so exciting to think about and to know that it exists, it's happening, and we get to go to it. You know, so it's good stuff.
I love it when like-minded organizations with similar causes work together. I always like to point out that in herpetology, whether we're talking herpetology, the academic herpetology, or herpetoculture, or anything herps, we are an extreme minority of the human population as a whole. And we have so much more in common just by having that shared passion that we should work together more often. When we say, hey, your goal's the same as mine, we shouldn't be like, competitor, it should be like, hey, let's work together. How can we make this better? And the fact that we're on the same page there, that's the model I think will work for us, because we are an extreme minority. And if we share this passion, let's all work together to make herpetoculture better. And I think bridging that gap is a big way to do that. You know, I don't know if you guys ever saw that thing I did with Zilla, Beyond the Glass, but my whole hope in that was elevating that. Care. Elevating care. And I think IHS is another one of those, elevate care. If we truly care about these animals, we should never, ever, ever utter the phrase, or hot take, sell an animal to someone who asks the phrase, what are the minimum care requirements? You add that M word in there, minimum, and I'm done. Like, for me personally, I'm like, okay, so have a good day. That's not what I'm looking for. Yeah. And I think as a community, and I know a lot of people shy away, oh, community. When you're this small nation, you have all the same friends, you're a community. I'm sorry, that's the dictionary definition. you know, the community as a whole working towards, you know, advancing care in a way that's beneficial to the animals, you know, in a way that's enriching their experience as the kept. You know, I don't think in the past we talked about that quite enough. And look where we came from, hot rocks and astroturf. You know, my first enclosure was a hot rock and some. And if you were broke, you went to Home Depot to get the AstroTurf, or the local hardware store before Home Depot took over, because you couldn't afford the sheet of AstroTurf from the store. So we've all been there.
Yeah. And it's, you know, to your point, think about where we started and where we're at. I mean, at the beginning of this episode, we're just talking about this brand new product and all its capabilities. And it's so exciting that what we do have access to. And that's what it comes down to, is it's, we have access to it. It's making the decision to invest in these things and not not trying to be as completely minimalistic as we can, you know, on
absolutely.
These. And to everyone listening, it's, don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that every one of us have to have the Taj Mahal of, you know, yeah. of Cage. It's always looking to those little things we can do to better it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's, we may not have to have all of this lighting systems or all of these, you know, the top-notch cages, the newest cages on the market, but it's, if you're going to invest $500 in a snake, maybe invest the same amount in its caging, you know, or it's, and I don't even mean in that one animal. It's just kind of, you know, making sure that we know for every animal we're purchasing or whatever dollar amount we're spending on new animals, there should be a percentage being spent on upgrading, you know, equipment and caging that same year type of thing.
Yep.
100%. That's something forward. That's something Aquatics World actually does a little bit better than Herpticulture. Another hot
a little bit better.
Oh, they are hardcore on it. Yeah.
I speak at both aquarium clubs and reptile societies. I've presented actually at both fish meetings and reptile meetings at aquatic shows and herp shows. And what I've seen is saltwater keepers not going to have any qualms spending 10 times the value of the fish for the enclosure, especially the predator fish tank people. And I like to use this analogy, which I probably shouldn't, but I will. When you're keeping, you have a relationship with that animal. And when we take it into the context of a relationship, we're not saying you have to provide a mansion. But if you're doing the very least you can, that relationship's probably going to sour. You got to do the best you can as your individual. And if it's outside your realm to give it what you can, then don't pick that animal. Like if you're like, hey, 120 gallons is way too big for me. Well, guess what? Here's the categories that are available to you. But if they have enough room and you're feeling bad, you can't do the max yet. Not everyone has the budget to do that. Just do your very best. Always be enhancing. Always be upgrading. And if you do it slowly by surely, pretty soon you'll be on the level you never thought you'd be.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah. So if you're interested in IHS, the website is up. Okay. It is iherpsimp.org. Obviously, www is before that. The schedule is up. The first day of the meeting is June 19th, which is Wednesday, and that's kind of arrival day. The meeting is in Knoxville, Tennessee, so it's a really good location because it's kind of centrally located. And it goes through Sunday, and then Friday is the Advancing Herpetoculture Sessions. And I'm not going to name all the people that are presenting, but two of our former guests are presenting, so I'm going to give them some credence. But Roy Blodgett, who's my partner in crime in organizing this, he's with Project Herpetoculture. You all have heard me say that's my favorite podcast outside of CCR, of course. He's going to actually be talking about monkey-tailed lizards, Pelecris, and he was a guest on our show. And then the one, the only, the myth, the legend, Chris Montross from Dark Horse Herpetoculture. The title of his talk is Hidden Beauty, Natural History and Husbandry of Mangrove Salt Marsh Snakes, which I might have like five of those at home right now, so I'm pretty pumped about that. And then I'm giving a talk, and my talk's going to be on naturalistic keeping strategies for hognose snakes. And I'm not just focusing on the plains hognose snake. I'm going to do all of them. Easterns, Mexicans, Southerns, the whole genus will be covered. But we have, you know, Zach Brinks from Josh's Frogs. That's fun to say. He's going to be talking about frogs. We have Jim Harrison and Kristen Wiley coming in. They're going to be talking about the care and husbandry of the Cascavel, which is Crotalus durissus terrificus. Pretty badass snake. Wayne Hill, the guy who literally came up with the Orlando Herp Show, which is now Daytona, as we all know it. He's going to be talking about Nile softshell husbandry. So the fun thing about this is it's not just snakes. Those snakes are heavily there, but we tried to get people from across the herpetocultural spectrum. So highly, highly, highly recommend it. Go to the website, look it up. And you can message me, you can message Mike, you can message others. And you have anything else you want to say about this before we go on to aquatic snakes?
Yeah, just a couple things I wanted to highlight real fast that are kind of exciting opportunities that people might not be aware of. But on Wednesday, June 19th, which happens to be my 20-year wedding anniversary, see how that happens every year with IHS.
Yeah.
Wife actually has to come this time because it's 20 and it's
nice.
Mm-hmm. We have an optional behind-the-scenes tour of the Great Fossil Site, which has a bunch of fossilized herps from turtles and tortoises to crocodilian, and that's really exciting. And we have a talk on that in the symposium as well as a poster presentation. So to get the full package, you'll have the poster, the talk, and an optional behind-the-scenes tour. Please go to our social media page for that. I will be adding that to the website as well. Also want to highlight that IHS is always paired with behind the scenes tour, and Zoo Knoxville has a brand new herp house, and we're going to get that special behind the scenes tour just by attending IHS. So you don't want to miss that. And then the final night of IHS is the banquet. We've got great food, usually lots of fun. Everyone's laughing and just always a great time. There's an auction, but the big highlight of the banquet is always that banquet speaker. As you mentioned, Zach, last year was John Murphy, who's a great friend and an amazing speaker. This year, we have none other than Bruce Means. And if you saw his doc on Disney Plus, we're getting the real life version from him. That's incredible. I mean, I think in terms of speakers, this year we've got some really, really good speakers on the schedule. That alone, before the zoo tour and the optional behind the scenes tour, and the fact that you're by those Smokies for herping. We also have Graham Reynolds talking about Caribbean boas. And like, if you're into Caribbean boas at all, that's the dude you want to hear from. He's opening IHS up. So I just want to highlight those couple things. Like you said, iherpsimp.org. That's simp with a Y. And our registration, by the way, updated this year. You can totally register online. It used to be a PDF. You had to print off and sign up, but it's all automated online now. So it's a lot easier.
There you go. So you have questions about IHS, hit us up. I will happily talk to you. I will be there the entire time. I'm bringing three students, and they're all going to be presenting. One of them is going to be presenting on modeling he did with a bunch of Plains hognose snake data. Another one is my grad student, Casey, who's working with Temistema, which, you know, that's badass, Temistema schlegi at St. Augustine Alligator Farm. They're trying to get them to produce eggs, and so he's doing a great big ethnographic analysis. And then the third grad student is Bree Light. And she is doing her thesis, of course, with false water cobras. Those false water cobras I was talking about at the beginning of the show, those were her study subjects. And we were testing the efficacy of heating up snakes dorsally with a heat lamp versus ventrally, and looking at, do you get shifts in behavior, physiology, growth? So we basically kind of tested heating with a light bulb, heating with heat tape is kind of what it boils down to. And that paper is really cool because I went into it thinking that there might be some differences. I didn't realize that there were the differences that there are. So anywho, so that just gives you an idea of what's going down. So with that being said, hard, you know, turn to the left or right, whatever direction.
Hard transition.
Yeah, hard transition. Now we're going to be talking about aquatic snakes. Now, when we say aquatic snakes, there's got to be people listening like, what the hell does that mean? So in the case of Mike, he keeps across clades. So as the science guy here, I can't just say one clade. So I will let Mike explain what we mean by the term aquatic snake in this instance. So when you say you're an aquatic snake keeper, which species and why those species? And then we'll get into the care and husbandry and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, so primarily Homolopsidae, which is your Asian rear-fanged fully aquatic snakes. Now you might be like, why Homolopsidae? Because they are the most fully aquatic and readily available of the aquatics. And there's cross-application once you learn the tricks of one genus, move on to the next and see how that applies and the different challenges, which is, I think, what landed me on aquatic snakes. There's a few things, but I'll circle back to that because otherwise it's just going to be a spider web of ideas. We don't need that. So Homolopsidae make up the predominant portion of what I work with currently. That's not to say that other snakes like Helicops haven't and Hydrops haven't crossed my mind, but, you know, slightly more terrestrial. Then additionally, Acrocordis. I've been working with Acrocordis granulatus probably longer than anyone I'm aware of in the country consecutively, like nonstop and continually breeding. And I'm actually leaning towards going away from those because of certain implications of SFD, but I'm sitting on 15 babies of more on the way right now. Acrocordis juvenicus. So the Acrocordis is another family I work with. And then there's a few semi-aquatics that I also work with. Achula or Ahetula. A lot of people, I say, but the Asian vine snakes. I have Phrenicincta and Mctarazans-ish from Indonesia. They're also mm-hmm. fish eaters, but fully arboreal fish eaters. I've seen them in the wild. I observed their captive behavior, replicated it, or sorry, wild behavior, replicated it, and managed to get breeding out of them. But they're fully fish eater, never on the ground. So those enclosures are sticks above an aquatic feature, no terrestrial land. So when there's animals that thrive well in that environment, I'll also play with that. And interestingly enough, I can't advocate this because I haven't figured out if it's a great idea or a terrible idea. But I will say on some of the vine snakes, adding something like a rice paddy snake, which used to be Anhydrus plumbeus, now Hypsocopus plumbeus. But if you put some very aquatic snake at the bottom of these enclosures that are 4 feet tall and all branches, the fish that might want to kind of hunker down low when the snakes are hunting them don't have that option, because that sends them down to your homolopsids and up to the surface where the vine snakes can feed better. And I've actually found better feeding response in both species when cohabitated that way, which is something I'm going to explore further as I have offspring. And I'm like, you know, let me try some in here and see if that actually is beneficial. Because it does seem to be, because the fish do learn, hey, these snakes are like dropping down from the branches, and as long as we stay far from the surface, they can't get us. But if there's another snake trying to eat you and you run out of options, that frenzy stirs a lot better feeding. And that kind of is a good segue, I guess, since we didn't have a segue, yeah. Let's throw one in there. What got me kind of down this path?
Now, that was the now, next I'll, question. So,
yeah, and I'll admit, like, part of it's just preference. I've always liked the challenge. I find, like, I've got a bad habit of, if I feel I've got it really dialed in, then I kind of get bored, and I'm not doing this for mm-hmm. any sort of profit. By the way, if you want to make money on snakes, ignore everything I say and just throw aquatic snakes out of your mind. Because of the cost of fish feeders and electricity, I have a solar unit and a natural gas backup because of all the fish tank pumps that cost so much. But backing up, reversing, and getting to your question, which wasn't asked but answering anyways, what got me into it? Mm-hmm. I think it's the fact that when you deal with aquatic animals, and this came from, I also used to keep coral on the side, and that's a whole side venture we won't get into. You have layers in that habitat. And when we talk about bioactive, it's like, hey, let's add some springtails and some beneficial bacteria and beneficial fungi to the soil and maybe some small invertebrates. But that's really where it stops, because you're usually feeding your animals in cycles. Their prey isn't among them. You don't see natural hunting behavior and posing in most herps, simply because it's not a safe thing to do. You can't have a ball python just throw a bunch of rats in and go, hey, if I get lucky tonight, I'm going to see it eat a rat. Whoops. Like, that's not going to work. And there's very few animals where you could, like, even your geckos continually having crickets with them 24/7, ill-advised with most species. Mm-hmm. However, with most of your aquatic snakes, and not all, but most, having a large school constantly available of their preferred prey is the best way to do it. Not only that, but there's other fish you can keep with them that are not prey items to the snakes. So you end up with a layered ecosystem that you mm-hmm. get to really dive deep. You could get down to the tannins, the leaves that occur where they're from. And because there's just so much, I guess, more playroom in terms of all of the potential factors. Like, I've gone as far as to test water from places and get a 62-element breakdown of the minerals in the water to see if that's a variant from what I have at home. That's something that you don't normally get. And it's basically like, let's take the worst challenges of aquatics, the worst challenges of herpetoculture, and merge them together. That's where I'm at. It's stupid, but it's fun, because you really like, I'm admitting it straight up. Like, hey, this is terrible information if you want to make a living at this. However, if you want to have some fun, guess what? All of your beautiful ornamental shrimps, they do freaking great with tentacled snakes. Now, you can't do catfish as bottom cleaners. What if the snake eats it? That's a big risk. Well, what about pom-pom crabs, freshwater pom-pom crabs, bamboo shrimp, viper shrimp? You know, their primary prey is going to be your live berries, your mollies and guppies. But if something's too big for them, they'll ignore it. If it's too small for them, they're probably going to ignore it. Now, with the herpeton, probably, strong probably, they might still eat it. But if it's too big, they're going to leave it alone. The same thing carries down the line with my other species. Granulatus, for example, weird thing. They know what not to eat. I've kept a green spot pufferfish in two of my granulatus tanks for over 15 years. Now, if you quarantine them for 6 months, which is what is required, they are no longer toxic, so no longer a danger to the snake. It is an environmentally acquired toxin. So after a long quarantine, throw them in. That's a cohabitant. And the fact that you have cohabitants with aquatic snakes and you have all of these different layers that play into the same puzzle, it's just an exciting naturalistic level of bioactive that I haven't seen the same level of satisfaction personally in keeping other things. And yeah, it's more challenging and yeah, it's more expensive, but at the end of the day, the reward of target training the fish to feed off a single spot. So if you come over and you want to see a snake feed, I drop a sinking pellet down. The fish come. I'm not bringing the food and sticking in the snake's face. The snake knows that's where the fish come to, and you'll get to see them ambush. And you'll get to see the differences, the dimorphic behavior in Acrocortis granulatus, where the female are ambush hunters, but the males are stalk and hunt. You'll see that actively as the male swims in, makes a pass, and comes back, and the female just sits there. And you go, that's what they do. The female does this, the male does that. It's not the same between the sexes. It's just for me. I mean, you could tell by me getting all amped up about it. Mm-hmm. Extra rewarding. And again, it's I come from it. I enjoy the observation part of keeping. It's why, you know, I'm not a big rack guy. I've got big enclosure. I've got two herp rooms with way less herps than you'd expect in two herp rooms. But it's because for me, the enjoyment comes from going in there at night. And I never turn the lights on. I've got a little flashlight and going tink to tink and observing what they're doing, you know, seeing what they're up to. My favorite herping experiences, surprisingly enough, aren't necessarily always the rarest herps. It's when what they're doing is what they normally be doing. And I just happen to be there. Last winter, I guess it was December, not that long ago, the wife and I were in Singapore and we came across a clouded monitor that was digging and hunting and rutting and pulling up bugs and grubs and just eating them in front of us. And for me, even though it wasn't the coolest herp of the trip, it was the coolest field herping experience. Because getting to see the animals be the animals. And with aquatic snakes, you get that a little bit more because they're not feeding in sessions and you're not disrupting whatever they're doing. I also never handle them. Once they're in the tank, that's home. Like, unless there's something medically wrong or I need to weigh and measure them, they're home. They're in their environment. The aquarium itself has multiple levels of fish for cleaning and for... you know, snails for shuffling the substrate, which is thick sand bed in most cases. And there's just so much going on that at any point, at any night, you bring out a flashlight, you check them out, and you're like, damn, that's cool. And it lives in my house.
Yeah.
And that's why aquatic snakes.
Gotcha. What was your first aquatic snake? What kicked it off for you?
So my very first aquatic snake is not a good starting point, but it was in my first fully aquatic snake. So I had garter snakes as far back. I got my first Florida blue garter snake at 6 years old. I had a lot of Nerodia. I had Pygee. I had a lot of North American water snake. So I had to get rid of all of my Nerodia, which at the point I had a lot, and had some space and had some enclosure set up. So my first pickup was actually an Acrocortis javiticus, elephant trunk snake. Still suspect that was actually mislabeled. Looking at the old photos going, are you sure that's not Arafura? Like, it kind of looks like one. And I hope not. That should have been imported, but it was from some random seller at some random reptile show, in Victorville in the fairgrounds in like 1999. And then fast forward, the very next herp show I went to, maybe a few herp shows later, Philippe, did Vosgely, which I always, butcher the poor man's name, but a literal legend. Like, I got my first ball python, who I still have, or my mom got her for me, from a mall pet shop where you got the black and white book by Philippe that told you how to keep your snake alive. So, you know, one of the OGs of herpticulture, he had Homolopsidae, and I got Homolopsidae. And then the next show I went to, there was Acrocortis granulatus from the Philippines, which used to come in, which are black and blue. And that's what got me into the hard ones. And, you know, if you want to talk about a snake that's going to make you lose your hair, Acrocortis granulatus. You hate your hair, get a granulatus. The rest will fall out.
So did you go out like thinking, I want to go into, you know, these species or this kind of snake? Or was it you saw it and it was like, you know what? I'm going to try that. Was it like, what was the mentality on it? Because it's such an obscure, you know, kind of realm. I didn't know if it was, you know, you wanted it and then found it, or saw it and thought, what the hell I'm going for?
No, it was. So my very first exposure, I think, to any Homolopsidae was the Erpatona at the San Diego Zoo. And I saw those as a little kid with my family. And ever since, I wanted to work with them. So when the opportunity presented itself, I'm like, aquatic Asian snakes, those are so cool. I had a fish tank growing up. I had the familiarity with filtration and water chemistry. So I thought this might be something I'm good at. But to be perfectly honest, aquatic snakes were a side faction of my collection for a very long time, simply for two reasons. One, affordability, the most expensive thing to take care of hands down, Rat Eaters. I did retics way more money than retics or anything like that. So I was fiscally restricted. Also, I didn't have the power to do so many fish tanks. Fish tanks require heaters that are 800 watts and pumps that are 500 watts. And running all of that at once, I had kind of a max capacity that way. And I used to work a lot with South African culibrates. I did a lot of first ever South African culibrate breeding. Telescopus semiondulatus. I did a lot of vine snake breeding. Some weird Central American, but always culibrate, culibroid. With aquatic snakes being the section of the room, as much electricity as I could handle before my breaker tripped. The aquatic snake started getting big about 15 years ago. And then I moved to Hermosa Beach, California, and I had to shrink it back down. Once again, power. Also, my apartment floor was wobbly, and I was worried that if I had, bad. You know, a stack.
That could be bad.
Yeah, right? Like, dude, water weighs 8 pounds a gallon. Yeah. And that's like rounding down. So you talk about a room full of 150-gallon aquariums. By the time I left my Hermosa apartment, if you stepped in the middle of the room, the floor bowed and the water would shake in all the tanks. So I was maxed out because if I had any more, I'd have the garage below me. But I was still – I was past max. Moving out to where I am now in Joshua Tree, when we looked at houses, we're like, okay, it's got to be single story. Concrete floor, good room for aquatic yeah. snakes, and this is going to allow that expansion that I've never been able to have. And over the past couple of years, where I had groups of three and four of things, now I'm going up to, you know, try to get to tens and 20s of things. And again, there isn't an end game where I'm like, oh, I'm going to be this like aquatic snake vendor selling to all these people. It is still just chasing that passion, but unfortunately, with a lot of the animals I work with, I have the only groups of those species in the country. Mm-hmm. And if something happens to my group of three, then they're gone, and I don't know when I can ever get them again. And I'm sure you guys have had it happen. I've had it happen way too many times, or something I worked with that I really liked, I could never get again. I just mentioned Telescopus semiondulatus. I used to breed a ton of those, a ton of Semophis mozambicus. Like species that you just can't find in the pet trade at all anymore in the horticulture side of things, because that torch wasn't carried on, which is why now I'm moving towards bigger numbers. Cause that way, if one tank has some catastrophic incident, they're still backup to backup. And that's honestly, when it comes to breeding them, my interest is more establishing them in horticulture than it is ever turning a profit on this. I just want that these animals can be available for other people that want the challenge to work with and observe things, because through my keeping, I've made observations and talked to people like John Murphy and Justin Bernstein, going, hey, has anyone ever observed this? Are people aware that, you know, granulatus are not just behavior dimorphic and they're not just size dimorphic, because they're also fairly size and body structure dimorphic, but also pattern dimorphic, and that dimorphism is an ontogenetic change? Oh, no? Okay, well, by the way, there you go. I think the cool thing about aquatic snakes is if you really get into it, these are animals that are very hard to observe in the wild. They live in mud. The common name for the Homolopsid family is the mud snake family, right? Mud yeah. is not easy to observe mm-hmm. through. I mean, I'm talking to a crayfish dude here, you know.
Yeah. yep, I like mud.
So, like, you know, we jokingly call them the muddy buddies, but, you know, the muddy buddies aren't easy to observe in the wild. This captive situation allows for observations of things that we might have missed in the wild. Things like caudal luring in snakes that we didn't mm-hmm. know caudal lure. New observation. Things like oxygen sequestration in elephant trunk snakes. Like myself and another, Tony Dorr, were corresponding going, have you ever seen this? Like literally the snake going up to the surface, gathering as much air as she can, going back into her shelter, exhaling, doing that a few times, and then not off that she uses. Now, we can only assume they might use this in the wild too, but I know six captive animals that make scuba bubbles, so they actually might know how to sequester oxygen so they don't have to expose themselves to predators as often. That's so awesome. Wow. And that stuff we wouldn't have known except for captive observation.
Wow. Very, very cool. Very neat. So, when it comes to keeping snakes, and we're definitely going to have you back on again. Not that we're going to cut this off now, but I'm just looking at the time. And if we were to do this justice, this is going to be a 4-hour episode. So we'll just kind of cover basic overall keeping for all of them. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
What would you say is, if you're talking to somebody like me who thinks, you know what, I'm going to dive down this path too, because I have Erpatin from you. Those are tentacled snakes, by the way. The three that I got from you are upstairs in this building right now. I've kept Plumbia before, the rice paddy snakes, and they were great. They actually were on my desk in a 20-gallon long for a little while.
Fantastically underrated.
Yes.
Yep.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. And they're little. Like, they're the perfect – they max out at, like, just at a foot, maybe less.
They're small and compact.
Yeah. So what would be, like, the – so you think you want to do aquatic snakes. Here's what you need to know. What would you tell somebody, you know, what would be your pitch? The good and the bad. Because one of the things we do on our show, which we strive for, is we don't ever try to paint the world through rose-colored glasses. Like, I love false water cobras more than anything. I also don't know how many times I've told people they crap more than a toddler and they stink. And, you know, you got to deal with a lot of airflow and the food bill is high. So, like, you know, but the reward is exponentially awesome as far as I'm concerned, because they're the smartest damn snakes I ever work with. So, like, we negative, positive. So if you were to kind of do that with your knowledge base and these, like, fully aquatic setups, what would the pitch be? What would you tell somebody?
Well, I think step one is starting with the right animal, because it's so different than horticulture. I often tell people, if you want to keep an elephant trunk snake and you don't want to step one, buy some discus and keep those alive. Get your aquaculture skills on point before you jump into these, because it's more aquaculture than it is horticulture. And a lot of people go into PetSmart, they throw on a hang on the back filter with carbon. By the way, carbon does nothing. It removes scent and it removes color, so you think the water's clear. Doesn't mean your nitrates are in check. It doesn't mean what nitrites are in check. Understand the nitrogen cycle, okay? Understand what it means when you have too much ammonia, how that affects pH, and the ripple effects of different water chemistry. Really understand that. Get a fish tank. Start there. And if you're not going to want to start with a fish tank because you just don't like fish and you like seeing them die, and that's why you want aquatic snakes, because you're a little bit fish sadistic, I'm not going to judge. We can talk about that later. Start with something like a rice paddy snake. Start with something that's die hard. Don't start with something that's incredibly difficult. Now, a lot of people start with elephant trunk snakes, and okay, you can. I don't recommend it. But if you're going to, filtration. Please keep in mind that not all filters are equal, that biological filtration is a must, and that if your filter is just some carbon package sponge, you're not going to succeed. Secondarily, make sure you live in an area where you can get feeder fish. And I don't know why this is such a thing, but it is. Because goldfish and rosy reds, and yes, when I say and rosy reds, I mean they're on the same level, are crap feeders. They're not good. They are poison to your animal. All of the carps, the Sopranidae, have thymidines. You feed your snakes exclusively that, their B1 depletes. And what happens? Now you see this in Thamnophis, but it's a little slower onset. You can catch it and stop it. In a garbage snake, they eat too many goldfish. They start acting a little head wobbly, you know, and they got kind of that stoned look to them. Yep. You're like, oh, okay, that's not good. My garbage snake's stoned. I should switch the diet. You've got a warning period. Aquatic snakes. Head wobbly underwater equals drowning. It is a lot more immediate and a lot less warning. So you won't know. And it varies species to species. Homolopsis bucata, which is another great aquatic snake. The puff-faced water snakes actually work with two species in the genus Homolopsis. They come in a lot of morphs. Personable, fairly diehard. They take years for that buildup to actually kill them or have a negative effect. However, something like an Erpatin, you could see it in a matter of 6 to 9 months. So understanding that you need a non-carp feeder is a huge place to start. If you don't have the feed source, don't get into it. Also, if you're not willing to pay for tilapia fry in lieu of an available food source, this might not be where to go. It's expensive, okay? Like you said, it's expensive, just like false water cobras, except there's a lot less poop. By the way, elephant trunk snakes pretty much don't poop. So if you hate poop, there's a point in that box. Keep in mind, yeah, and I hate poop, so point in box. I'm taking it. Less poop, winner, winner, chicken dinner. besides the poop part, if you get that cute baby, soft looking elephant trunk snake, and let's be real, they're freaking adorable and tempting as heck. You see my show, it's like $100. Why not? Well, why not? that animal is going to grow to the point where she's going to be a 6-foot beast that eats oysters every week. Do you have the budget to be spending $15 a fish times 20 fish? Sometimes every month, because they can be bingy. They'll go through a period where they're like, I'm not going to eat for 2 months. Can be stressful at first. That's just how they do. And then next month, wipe out 20 fish that you paid $15 a piece for. If you're not financially ready to feed that mouth, don't get that mouth. Because that mouth is going to be more expensive than the python eating rabbits. It's insane. I mean, it really does add up. Because in addition, you're going to have your water test kits. Another key point. Test strips suck. Do not use them. Get a proper water test kit. But these are all things, like I said, keep discus, keep a saltwater fish, familiarize yourself well with aquaculture, and then jump into aquatic snakes. Don't try to go from the rack to the fish aquarium where just a little bit of parameters being off will collapse the ecosystem, because almost all of these snakes have the same fatal flaw. When the water chemistry gets bad, that stresses the animals out. When the animals get stressed, their immune system suppresses. And then there's a host of all sorts of horrible fungal pathogens, some of which are deadly contagious to your terrestrial snakes and the local environment, that they then get. Acrocornis are very prone to SFD, snake fungal disease. I'm sure you guys know exactly the risk there. But if you do a water change into your local stream with your elephant trunk snake, you could wipe out all the snakes in your neighborhood. So never do that. That's another thing, is because the fungal risk of aquatic snakes, because some of them can carry SFD along with a host of other funguses, you have to be ready to have an enclosure that you are going to be disinfecting a lot and around it a lot. I literally have hospital grade accelerated hydrogen peroxide, which is not regular hydrogen peroxide, in a little Swifter mop that I mop my room with every day. Because unlike terrestrial snakes, say you touch a snake with SFD, you disinfect your hands, you move on to the next tank. And unless you're picking up bedding and dropping it on the floor, there's probably no, chance you've spread it to the room. In an aquatic snake tank, all of that water is now contaminated. And a drop of water falling off of your hand on the floor, that patch of floor is now contaminated. You have to decontaminate the whole room every day, all the time. Are you ready for that? If the answer is no, you've got your answer. Stick to something that isn't going to have those issues.
So I've got two questions that, two things you mentioned. One is just subtle, and obviously there's going to be many, but you talked about the filters and, how like carbon, doesn't do anything. And it's funny because I can translate that to, we use carbon scrubbers in our rodent rooms, and that will get rid of the smell. However, until I was able to vent that out, still vent the room to the outside world, the ammonia was still present. The carbon scrubbers couldn't touch the ammonia, and you could walk in and it wouldn't smell like rodent room, but it could burn your eyes if it was, the day that it needed to be cleaned kind of thing. So excellent point on that. Is there a filtration system or a certain type that you would say, look into this? This is what I would say, look into if you're going to be keeping these kinds of snakes.
It's really going to vary species to species. And here's why. This isn't like one animal. And if we're talking about like one animal, then I'd say, okay, if you're talking Acrocornis, you have to have a sump. You need a lot of filter media and a lot of water, about a third. So if you got a 120, think you need a 40-gallon sump. Because you don't want high flow, but you want high filtration. That's a big animal eating big fish. And if you have 15 oysters, so the old school rule was an inch of fish per gallon of water, right? And I'm breaking that rule. But the way you can break that rule is more filtration. You actually base that number on the filtration and not the actual tank capacity. That's the old way of doing it. The better way to do it is look at your actual capacity based on filtration. That said, you don't want high flow. So there's a lot of math that goes into it, but it's sump. If you have anything large aquarium, sump's the best route. However, certain things like rice paddy snakes and certain things like erpeton, tentacled snakes, you could do a canister filter. You're never going to be looking at a hang-on-the-back filter. These are still snakes. They'll still escape. You have that risk, plus there's nothing to it. But you guys mentioned ExoTerra, so I'm just going to say that I use a lot of Fluval products. And if they have new filters you want me to test, let me know. But, like a Fluval U4 for a small enclosure, a lot of these snakes do well in half-filled aquariums with a tiny corner blocked off and some peat. They do occasionally burrow into the mud. They're called mud snakes. So giving that mud landing, they tend to use that when they're about to go blue, which is when you see fungal outbreaks. That little mud landing is great. But now you're talking, so my classic setup for a lot of your basic fungal lobs today, 40 breeder, corner, pond foam with egg crate to hold it in place. It can seep a little bit. That's fine. It keeps the peat moist. Fill that up with peat. crap ton of sticks. If you could see the snake easily, you did aquatic snakes wrong. Fluval euphor, not the biggest filter. You're going to have to change it a lot. But again, that's a filter based on bacteria. It's got ceramic media. You could change it to any other media. You want a filter that integrates bacterial media, not chemical media. The only chemical medium really that, in my opinion, that's worth anything would be Purigen. But here's why I still don't even like Purigen. Most of these snakes occur in murky, brown, tannic-tinted waters. They're tropical. Well, go to the tropics and look at the water. It's always brown. Why is it brown? Because there's plants. Leaves fall in the water, creates tea. Tea is just leaves in water, right? So they live in tea. They don't live in clear water. Purigen and carbon both strip out the tannins. You're never going to get your water the proper tint if you're using chemical media. So I guess the long story short version is you need to make sure you have appropriate filtration for your capacity of fish and snake. That needs to be bacterial-based and not chemically-based. Chemical media is just going to make you go crazy going, why can't I keep the tint up? And if you don't have that tint, if you don't have the tannins, there's very few aquatic snake species that thrive well without tannins, in my opinion. And that's based on both observations of the habitat, because I've gone to Indonesia a bunch of times and found them in the wild and got like, okay, cool, that's what I should do. And just firsthand experience. Clear water is not necessarily ideal in this situation. And I'll add additionally, there's been a lot of research done on the antifungal properties and the antibacterial properties of many of the tannins used. It's funny to me that it was almost like an aha moment that tea tree leaves in aquatic snakes reduce the fungal pathogens. When tea tree leaves have been used for tadpoles for years, they've been used for shrimps for years, they've been used for discus for years. Mm. How come it was like unknown that, hey, yeah, and snakes. But by the way, and snakes. And these tannins are in the leaves for a reason. These are plants that live in tropical areas of water, and it keeps them from becoming rotted over when they're on the freaking tree. So it makes sense that that carries on. And also, interestingly enough, there is some research going on with the University of Florida that Ophidiomyces, the SFD, might have actually originally been a plant fungus. So these botanical antifungals, it could have been, they think it was actually an aquatic plant fungus that jumped to snakes in an aquatic setting. So when you look at Acrocordis that seem to all be cultured with it, they could be patient zero. I hate to be the one to say that, but I've sent multiple samples off now, and that white spot fungus in Granulatus and Gingivitis, so far, it proves out to be SFD. You can't get it from sheds, which is the problem. People are setting in sheds like you would any other snake, and the water breaks it down too quickly, so you don't get any results. But if you actually do a puncture biopsy of the fungus and send that in, it's SFD. And the Moscow Zoo found the exact same thing. They found SFD in the granulatus. Well, here you have a fungal pathogen that probably jumped from aquatic plants into snakes at some point. And I probably consult on Acrocordis care when they get imported 2 to 3 times a week. Everyone buys them and everyone knows, oh, rush to Clarkson and ask him how to take care of them now that you bought the animal. Please do that first. Next time, doesn't usually happen. Usually they hit me up when the animal's already got fungus. And I could say that, I mean, granulatus are imported a ton. To my knowledge, I'm the only breeder in the United States. Still breeding them, but still the only breeder. And it appears to me that when I follow up with people, go, how's your snake going? They have a 99% failure rate in captivity due to SFD, which is a big concern, which is why I said it initially. I'm really considering breaking up my groups, not letting them reproduce because of that risk, because of the fact that there's a fungal pathogen that, I mean, like I said, they very well could be patient zero. We don't have the data to back it yet, but it does kind of look that way.
I'm going to jump back real quick. And, you know, we talked about the filtration, but I also want to put out just for the listeners, if someone was going to try their first aquatic snake, what is the species you would recommend they go with? What's got that hardy, I don't like using the word starter, you know, for an aquatic snake here, but what would be the one you say, you know what, you're probably going to have the best level of success with this one?
Well, I mean, I go back to rice paddy snakes because I got them for a reason. I got into rice paddy snakes for one reason, the size. 12-inch snake does fine with a small group in a 40-gallon breeder and very, very, very die hard. You can mess up a lot and they seem to recover very well. So rice paddy snakes would be right up there. Another one which I mentioned, Homolopsis. The only drawback to Homolopsis, puff-faced water snakes, is they get slightly larger. But they come in albino, they come in leucistic, they actually come in two types of albinos. There's a lot of morphs and there's a lot of play around room there, which is exciting. And they are more forgiving than most. I'd say after that, There's no one really breeding anhydrous yet, and the wild-caught specimens do kind of struggle a little bit to get established. So my first two suggestions, captive-bred Homolopsis, captive-bred rice paddy snake. Even wild-caught rice paddy snakes honestly do pretty well, but I like to encourage captive breeding. Homolopsis morphs, by the way, that are coming into the country right now, those aren't wild-caught morphs. They're actually breeding those in Asia, in Indonesia, and exporting them here. So a lot of your Homolopsis morphs that you're seeing going for crazy numbers are actually being bred over there. Like, you get to a point where it's like, wait, that's the 20th leucistic Homolopsis. There must be just a puddle of white snakes. Now, they caught on. They're worth more, so they're breeding them. A lot of your other aquatic snake morphs, like I have some morph Bacadams coming, and I've got a handful of other. Subsessor cori is another one I'm working with because of accounts. Sidetrack. So when I was in Cambodia, I made a network of friends there. I've been there a couple times, and Tonle Sap's like the mecca for aquatic snake field herping. And I spoke to someone who was setting up a nature center, and they were working with a lot of the snakes they caught in Tonle Sap, and they're having some struggles. The only one they had no struggles with and bred for them, and they couldn't seem to have anything go wrong with. And we're talking, they just didn't have the resources. It's not easy to set up enclosures in a place where, you know, aquaculture isn't popular, was Bacordi. So Bacordi could be one, but until I personally have the experience, I can't say. But yeah, number one would be rice paddy snake, captive bred if you can. Number two would be Homolopsis. A lot of the morphs are captive bred. And probably once you get through those two, then I'd say start entertaining things like tentacled snakes. And then if you want to get a mega monsters tank, probably you could look into your elephant trunk snake. Just remember, you need a mega monster tank. You need, like, you know, 150 gallons is still kind of small. And then if you are just a masochist, you can consider Acrocordis granulatus, but just keep in mind that that is a brackish, black water, highly sensitive snake that typically lives in both estuary and marine environments, but can't drink salt water, and the feeders have to be salt tolerant. So you're now looking at live berries and tilapia is about your only two options, unless you want to shell out for damsels every week. And they'll eat, like, you know, 15, 20 fish a week. So $10 fish are not ideal. So yeah, that's kind of like, I guess the order would be, like, you start with the rice paddy. Other former anhydrous, if they become available calf bred, tend to be pretty hardy. Homolopsis, then graduate to Erpeton, Acrocordis. And finally, I'd say Acrocordis granulatus and Cerberus are the two hardest. Cerberus are also... the brackish snakes, which makes sense. You got a snake that goes from brackish to salt to sometimes fresh. There's probably some spatial ecology going on there that we're not privy to, especially something that occurs as deep as 60 feet into the ocean and like 20 miles offshore, and then right in the estuary where it's like a foot deep and dries up at low tide. Same snake, same range. There's a lot going on there. Of course, it's hard to keep in captivity. The more complex the natural ecology is, the more complex the care can often be.
So... final question before we get to our last question, but this may take a little while. Feeding them, because you've mentioned the thymonase, and I know that you recently went to, like, probably the single greatest act done by an individual herpetoculturalist to feed their animals, which is you live in a desert and you may have created a small estuary in your backyard. But anyway, so... What do you recommend as a feeder for these animals? And can you culture the feeder? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you can, because Mike's doing it right now. But let's kind of talk that whole thing through.
So feeders, that's a fun topic because it's really a big part of this. And I will say, and I don't want to say this prematurely, and I haven't said this anywhere, but I am making moves to try to make better feed options available to a wider scale of people. It's just finding parties interested in it becoming a part of this theoretical project, which is... Yeah. Mollies breed well. Goldfish are now three for a dollar. Let's freaking start getting some better feed fish options. I don't know why we landed on goldfish in the first place. That's the weirdest thing to me. They die readily in the pet shops. But, you know, I briefly owned a pet shop. So I went through that. You get 1,000, and then by the time you're like selling them, you got 700. You have to include that in the price, right? There's that problem. There's the fact they spike the ammonia intake, and then they're terrible feeders. So mollies would be a good alternative, and hopefully in the future that is one. So I'd say that your best feed options, obviously vary species to species. Tilapia are a good one to keep in mind. Check your state regulations. In California, I can only have Mozambique. I can't have Niles and I can't have Blues, but it varies state to state. Most tilapia breeders will sell fry 50 cents to a buck if you get the discount fry deal when you're buying 200. Set up a tank. These little tiny fry will be perfect feeder size in no time, a lot cheaper than buying the goldfish, you know, large goldfish that are going to kill your snake anyways. great way to take care of a lot of different species would be tilapia fry. Secondarily, guppies are fine, and mollies will breed like crazy. So to the point of breeding your own, I have done that with 150 gallon and mollies. If you keep a molly above 80 degrees and feed them a lot, they will breed like crazy. You just can't have too many snakes or you end up feeding them off faster than you go through them, which is my situation, which is why I built a 5,000 gallon pond in my backyard and hand laid 27 metric tons of rock and hand dug the hole because we couldn't fit power tools in my very small backyard. A little bit of an undertaking. But as I mentioned, I also have a solar system and natural gas backup generator just for the aquatic snakes. And then the garden, or the clean out for the pond water filtration system goes to the vegetable garden. And the vegetables from the vegetable garden are what I use to make my fish food so I can have nutrient-enriched fish food. So I'm gut-loading the fish that the snakes eat. So it's like one big whole house system just for a couple of weird wet snakes. My wife is very tolerant. But yes, you can bring mollies. Yeah. Another one is, depending on your climate, and no one's talking about this, I've got a box of 30 coming tomorrow. Uruguayan cichlids are good with pretty cold. And when I say pretty cold, if you get down to the 30s, so, you know, where I'm at, we do get snow once a year, right? People don't think about it. I'm at 3,600 feet elevation. Joshua tree gets snow. It gets cold. That's why you get pictures of Joshua trees with snow on it. They can survive my winter. Now, if you're in Montana, you're screwed. You should probably keep snow. I don't know. No offense, Montana. Bison. Mm-hmm. Bison do great there. But for a lot of the country, your Uruguayan cichlids, chanchitos, which were one of the first cichlids ever bred in the fish hobby, can handle it cold. And as long as you're in an area where they can't establish, we're not accidentally creating an invasive species, because obviously, come on, be responsible people. A big tank behind your house of those is a great idea. And while you're at it, something I'm additionally building, aquaponics. It's $100 on Amazon to buy an aquaponics system. Throw a couple gardeners, some vegetables. If you're trying to get this little idea here past your spouse, be it your husband or wife, just say, hey, babe, but what about the aquaponics? It didn't work for me, but you could try it.
Nice. Very cool.
All right. Sorry. One last thing. I almost forgot. My feeders. So I catch mollies that are introduced as a big portion of my feeders and then quarantine them and then salt shock them for parasite ridding. Whole thing we don't have time for. But my point for bringing that up is, look at USGS in your area and find the invasive species. And if you can find a way to make invasive fish feeders, you've just done a good thing for environment and saved yourself a ton of money. That's how I found my molly spot, by the way. That's how I got my feeders, was looking at what fish are invasive in my state, driving there and catching them. If you're in most of the Southeast, you probably don't need to buy feeders. You probably just need to find a map.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually did that. When I was keeping Nerodia in Florida, there were Gambusia in every freaking pond, and not all of those were a finis, or whatever the native species was. And I would go out, and all I would do is I had a butterfly net. I tied off the bottom of it so it wasn't a big cone, so it was more of like a pan. And then I would just put the net in this decorative pond. I know that I was the weirdo of the apartment complex, and then just take bread, throw it over top of there. All the Gambusia would come in, pick up the net, and then boom. And then I brought some of those Nerodia back with me, and I had to buy the damn guppies, and they were nowhere near the quality of what I was getting, you know, down there because of what they were feeding on. And I definitely missed it.
Yeah, if it's legal in your area, use the invasives, please. When I was breeding vine snakes, I actually used to tell the Florida collectors, I will not pay for green or nulls, but if you can ship me brown or nulls, I'll use all of those as feeders. And my purpose is like, I want that double-edged sword. I want my feeding to also have a positive ecological contribution. Let's be real. The ship has sailed on brown anoles, but I certainly don't want to decimate any green anole population. And the same with feeder fish. If you're in an area with invasive feeder fish, which, by the way, California has them, Arizona has them, almost every state has an invasive species somewhere in it or introduced, non-native. Not all of them are established invasive. A, if they're introduced, usually no regulation, double check. B, if they're non-native, usually no regulation, double check. And if they're invasive, they're probably regulated. Don't break the line, be dumb about it. But in many cases, there's no bag limits. You can catch as many as you want. And by the way, pro tip, Amazon has fish traps for like $10. You buy a couple of those, throw them in there, sit on the side of the road like a weirdo, just go, yeah, I just set a hood for fish. And then once you have them, there you go.
Nice.
Very nice.
So, well, this was great.
Do we want to ask our final question, Zach?
Sure do. You want to do it this time?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do it.
All right, cool.
I'm really interested to hear the response, being that you know, you're someone who is, in my view, and I think all of you here, someone who is actively attempting to shape herpetoculture.
Yes.
You know, right? Continuing to move things in a direction. So, you know, Mike, what I would like to know, with everything that is going on in herpetoculture, you know, the hobby, the industry, all of it, from, you know, the advancements in different keeping methods, to the litigation that tends to happen, you know, in some states more than others, to the divide that seems to occur from you like this species, I like this species, we can't be together anymore, to all of it. Where do you see the future of herpetoculture going? What do you see happening?
You know, I think this kind of comes full circle to what I said earlier, and I will harken back to the good old days, the 90s. I mean, I think when I look, and, you know, people that are real OGs can have even deeper perspective, but when I look at where we've come and where we're going and what's going right and what's going wrong, I wouldn't say we're necessarily in a bad direction. When we talk about the good old days, we're talking about hot rocks and AstroTurf, right? We've come a long way there. But there also wasn't quite as much divide. There wasn't as much differences. It was like, whoa, you like snakes? Cool, so do I. We're friends now. And I think part of that too is, you know, the business aspect of herpetoculture has become a bigger faction of it than it used to be, because it wasn't very many people's full-time thing. And I'm not knocking that. But what I would say is, I think our strongest future is somewhat united in this weird passion that we all share, and getting over the petty differences and realizing that, yeah, in some cases it might be a competitor, but rising tides float all boats. I think what I would love to see is more people, even if, like, look, if you're making your living off it, and as I said, I briefly owned a pet store, and in college, breeding was a lot of how I paid my bills. Mice and rat breeding, herp breeding really was a side income, right? So I get it. You got to do your bread and butter. You got to do the stuff that's going to make your money. But I'd love to see more passion projects at herp shows. Like, I love what Armin's doing with the Anoles. I love just going up to a table and be like, wait, it's just newts? You're like, just newts. Dude, that's awesome. I want to talk to you. I think that's like the richest future. That's the future I'd love to see, is more passion projects, because we should be in this because we're passionate, not because we think we're going to get rich. Because, I mean, look, you can make money at it. There's probably better ways to. And if you're making money at it, congratulations. Good job. But don't forget why you're doing it. Don't forget the passion. The second you make your hobby or job, it's really hard. And for me personally, that was a problem. It's really hard to not lose the spark, lose the reason, lose the why. I think as a community, we need to focus that it's that passion. It's that shared passion that we all have in common that should unite us. Because I'll be honest, if we keep fighting over really petty differences all of the time, and now you also have an increased, you know, political polarization. Mm-hmm. We are a massive minority. Just go back to when your friends at work call you the snake person. Now, Zach, maybe not you, the crayfish person, but otherwise, for the rest of
both.
Us, you know, besides the crawdaddy, yeah, you get it. Like even my wife at work, it's like, oh, she's the snake girl, and she, you know, granted, takes care of my collection like 6 months a year because I'm gone a lot, but like the snake person, that's who you are to the public. When you're with the other snake people, remember that. Remember, this is your community of very niche interest, and work together to better. If we work together, I think we'd be so much further. And like I said, more passion projects. I love the passion projects. I love when someone's pursuing a herp for no other reason than they like it. You know, a lot of the stuff I keep isn't worth crap. I'll never see an ROI, but you know what? I like it. And that's why I do it. And when I see other people doing that same thing, that's what I'm like, there it is. That's what I like to see. Because that passion, that enthusiasm, that's what's contagious to the public. You know what the public really isn't going to make them like snakes better? That you say, hey, I made 80 grand last year in snakes. You're probably not going to win it over. But if they just see you nerdy, passionate, as we all right now, you know, just amped up, eventually, as much as like, weirdo, freak, I guess that one's kind of pretty. And you could literally go on my own Facebook and see like my uncle go, that one's cool. Wait, who said that? Who never liked snakes? And you see, we've all seen it so many times. Passion breeds passion. Passion is super contagious. It's a great vector for conservation. Yep. And passion is found in those passion projects, those niche things. So that to me would be where I'd love to see it go. But to get there, we're going to have to remember there's not a lot of us. Let's work together. I'm not saying ignore the people that are doing bad. If you're doing bad, call them out, get them out. You know, if there's an unethical keeper, I'm not saying, hey, I don't care if they are smuggling. That's not what I'm saying. But for those of us who are ethical keepers, who are doing our best to do best by the animals, let's get along a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the word fact that you just said, ding, ding. There, it's like you making sure that we all understand there's a difference between an unethical keeper and an uneducated keeper.
That you know too, what I mean? 100%.
Yeah. And so it's don't flame and shame someone mm-hmm. who is seeking advice, someone who is reaching out for information. It's be that sympathetic and guiding hand that can help them learn. And because I can tell you, that's something that we see it online all the time, right? We see where people just get reamed. Oh my gosh. Yeah. But from someone who now has this shop, I have people come in all the time that they did their best on bad information, right? Yeah. They didn't know what they didn't know. All they knew is what they had been told. And you can see the look on their face sometimes as we're correcting this and telling them all this information that, and so they realize how wrong they've been doing it. And it's saying, hey, it's okay. You know what I mean? Don't worry about it. We're going to help you get there now, right?
Yeah, remember where you came from. You were that person at some point.
Exactly. And so that's just it. It's just understanding that there, if someone knows how it's supposed to be done and chooses to go a different route, that's where it becomes unethical. But guys, let's be the mentor to those that just didn't know better yet. Let's help them.
Yeah, gatekeeping only serves to keep people out. And why would you want to keep people out? I feel like there is a small minority of people that are like, no more. This is my hobby. I don't want any more in. But at the end of the day, herpetoculture benefits wild conservation because these people will often end up pursuing it academically. HCI every year has the Michael D. Grant. And we're always asking people, what got you into conservation? And 9 times out of 10, it was herpetoculture. It was something they kept. Don't gatekeep. Yeah. Don't keep the next generation out. Instead, be that person that someone was for you. Someone did it for you. And if they didn't, well, then be what you didn't have. But what I am so tired of is the gatekeepers, the holier than thou. I've hit this level, so now everyone is that not on this level I don't like. You know, to be honest, I get a little twitchy when someone corrects someone on poisonous versus venomous rudely when they have no idea. Like, venomous, venomous. Like, ho, calm down. Yeah, they are incorrect. They're also asking a freaking question that most people never would. So be cool. If they say gardener snake, yeah, sure. Yeah. At some point you could joke about it, but how about you just answer their question about Thamnophis first?
Right.
You know, let's try to be that welcoming, supportive spokesperson for reptiles and amphibians, because that's what we are. We are a spokesperson. And if we continue to be absolute hemipenes to people trying to come in, then the future is we get what we deserve. That would be our future. Yeah. We need to be the spokesperson for these animals that they don't have.
So on that note, you said spokesperson. I said that the last thing we were talking about was Herpetological Conservation International, and you are certainly the spokesperson for that. And I want to talk about the new book that you and I are both authors for chapters in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Book is not the right word. Tome, I think, is the correct term, because it's over 700 pages long.
Yes, it is.
Yes. So if you could speak to that and then how people can get said book, what the book's about, and then what the proceeds of the book are going to, because I am all about this stuff.
Absolutely. So a quick catch up. Unfortunately, the two organizations I'm president of have similar-ish names. Yes. They both have an I and an H. So International Herpetological Symposium, separate from HCI, Herpetological Conservation International, which was founded by myself, Devin Massane, who's a fellow television producer and a herpetoculturist and has done some studies in South Africa, Dr. Chip Cochran, originally Michael D. So we have this organization that's for conservation, and we've got a great board, a great team that we're always looking for the next project to fund, the next thing. And recently, we've added the Harold Boris Conservation Grant for Aquatic Snakes, and it's the research and conservation grant. We have Justin Bernstein's project with the Cerberus microlepis, the critically endangered baka dam in the Philippines. And we also have another project we're going to be announcing next week, and we're always looking for those projects. So what HCI is, it's a grassroots herpetoculture positive conservation organization, which, you know, there aren't a lot of that. A lot of people hear conservation, they think defenders of wildlife, they think it's the enemy of the state. And you'll notice US ARC shares our stuff. Obviously, you've heard everything I say. I'm a herpetoculturist. Absolutely embrace it. Absolutely ethical herp keeping is not the antithesis of conservation. That's what we want to get out there. And we also wanted to have something that herpetoculture could get behind. You love the animals, let's conserve them. So that's kind of where HCI came from. Obviously, the book came from John Murphy. I went to his house and we were talking about the book, and he said, hey, we weren't planning on having these chapters. Would you be interested in authoring them? And as it evolved, it became apparent that 700 plus pages, the print cost is going to be $225. It's not going to be a cheap book. And that lends it inaccessible to a lot of people. And something that is important is that accessibility information. You know, I hate pay gates on papers. I can't say I'm a big fan of Sci-Hub, but I use it. you know, because information should be for everyone. So John and I spoke and we said, what if we did an ebook as a fundraiser for the Harold Voris Aquatic Snake Grant? So the money that you donate to get that ebook, which is the full 712 page, you know, if Lawrence Klauber wrote the Bible to rattlesnakes, this is basically that for aquatic snakes. It covers every aquatic snake in decent detail. It's really a follow-up to Evolution in the Mud, which was John's book on Homolopsidae. Really, you know, I can't say about the sections I wrote, but as a work, it's amazing that it's available for $20. And I do want to put this out there because I feel like a lot of people also misconstrue conservation groups. 0% of the money that HCI ever receives ever goes to the board. In fact, every year I'm looking going, oops, I spent too much money on HCI this year, because as a board, we want every penny that we found it with this core principle that if I go to a reptile show and some kid hands me a fiver, that $5 bill is going directly to the project that they handed to me. No overhead, no retirement packages, no travel expenses, no compensation. If you're on the board of HCI, you're losing money. Welcome to HCI. It's like keeping aquatic snakes except drier. and that's basically what the ebook has materialized into. It's a great fundraiser for this one-of-a-kind aquatic snake research grant, which really there aren't dedicated aquatic snake research grants. And it's a group of animals that's highly imperiled. A lot of people don't think about that, but sea snakes are incredibly imperiled, just like most of the things in the ocean. Anything reef-dependent, sea snakes are highly specialized. So coral breaching could cause an entire group to disappear for a while. In fact, with Apiceros, we had some suspected extinctions that turned out not to be, but barely on the cusp. And then with Homolopsidae, you have water pollution and wetlands deconstruction and all these other pressures that other snakes have, but in different ways, and fungal pathogens. This is a group of animals that does need conservation focus, so that's why the grant was founded. And every penny of that $20 is going to go into a fund to fund the next aquatic snake conservation project that we found that would be highly impactful. And that's how we select projects, by the way. It's usually, I mean, I wish I could say, hey, it's a cool author, so we really want to work with them, but it comes down to what's the long-term impact. Is it going to impact just this one species in this one location, or does this research have ramifications? Is this research that then corresponds to, oh, well, the telemetry they did on this garter snake in Arizona, that applies really well to the hydrops that they're trying to survey in Bolivia. Like big, impactful pieces with the most efficient for our money. Because obviously raising money $20 at a time, we're not going to be all changed the world overnight, but we can make an impact together. Additionally, if you want to get the hardcover book, because I know I'm going to need a bunch of copies, you are too, we've got a sign-up form on the same page that offers the ebook, and we need you to fill that out, because currently we have no idea how many of these to print. So that email sign-up sheet is actually what we're basing off how many print. So for the final part of that question, how to get it, you can go to herpconservation.org or herpconservation.com. They both go to .com. it just reroutes. And then on the main page, you'll see on the top menu bar, aquatic snakes. If you go to the grant section, it'll say aquatic snakes book. And if you scroll down, it'll say aquatic snakes book. So go to the website. There's three different spots. You can't miss it. We did that on purpose. Click the link, donate a minimum of $20 to the Harold K. Voris grant, and you'll automatically be redirected to the ebook. And again, we've got a great bunch of authors on this thing. I think, what is it, total 13 authors, 120 yep. photographers out of 30 countries with over 400 species accounts. Everything from nature scene to homolopsidae and sea snakes to, I mean, there's even some boas in there. There's everything that has water as a big part of its ecology is in this book. And there's chapters of conservation. There's a lot in there. I personally have not actually cover to cover read it myself. And, you know, I read a big chunk, so.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I did the false water. This is full circle. So at IHS, I met John Murphy and was like, holy crap, this is one of my, you know, heroes, being an aquatic mm-hmm. snake nerd. And we were talking after he gave his talk at the dinner. And he mentioned that Hydrodynastes, false water cobras, were in there. And I asked how long the chapter was. And he said, well, you know, it was one of the shorter chapters. And here I am, and I just wrote a book on them. And I thought, that's not okay. So then I basically was like, hey, I can help flesh that out, not to intrude. He's like, we would love to have you. So, you know, that's, you know, I literally am talking to one of the people that when I was in college, I looked up to like a god. And now I'm, you know, an author in the book, and I'm happy as hell that it's co-authored between him and I. Like, that is just the coolest thing on earth. That's one chapter. My chapter is very small. There are chapters in that thing that are like 50 plus pages long. So if this podcast interested you in any way, go get that, because that's only going to help conservation. And that is how herpetoculture does conservation. We've been talking about this forever, is we can use our masses and our numbers and our interests and our passion, and a small donation that can go a long way to help save an animal. So there you go.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and John was great with making this very collaborative. Like, anyone that wanted to pitch in, he welcomed everyone. And even though I was delayed on my chapters, I mean, talk about a great guy. I just want to for a moment say, like, he did not miss expectations in terms of making this come together and then generously offering the ebook and putting it out there for us to use as a fundraiser, and advised us on the new grant when we were founding the grant. That was a lot of John's guidance, and just, you know, really grateful for the people that say, hey, I want to be a part of this. And I guess that's, if I could have one last parting thing, is like, hey, I want to get more involved with conservation, or I want to get more involved in these different things, reach out. Because a lot of the groups like HCI or IHS, I would immediately go, okay, cool. What are we doing? Like, it's not a closed society. It's not a closed club. If you want to get involved, reach out. We'd love to have you. 100%.
There we go. So if people want to get a hold of you, they want to talk aquatic snakes, they're interested in IHS, they're interested in HCI, they're interested in the snake book, aquatic snake book, how do you recommend people do that? And you do live a very busy, hectic life. Yeah, I will say that right now.
Yeah, I will say, like you guys know, my actual profession is television. That's what pays for all the snakes, and that takes me out of the country 6 months at a time. So if you ever do message, email, or whatever, I don't get back to you right away, just keep doing it, because eventually I'll be like, oh, shoot, that's right, I need to, because there is a little bit too many spinning plates at the moment. But I basically do live on social media. That's always open, because that's for casting and other contacts. So on Facebook, M-Y-K-E Clarkson, like Kelly. And on Instagram, same thing, Mike with a Y, Clarkson. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Personal website's a complete mess, so don't bother with that. But yeah, the easiest way is social media. I'm always on there. And if you just go, hey, heard you on the podcast, just mention where you heard me from, where you heard of me, because like the number of scams we get is pretty high. Either that or just shoot me an email, which is myke@herpconservation.com or .org, and I'll get back to you. Or myke@palamisproductions.com, which we don't even have time to get into Palamis.
We don't. Very cool. Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you for coming on. This was a great one. I love when we cover something for the first time. I don't think there's ever been a homolopsid husbandry podcast in the history of podcast. I could be dead wrong, but, you know. Good.
Well, if you ever want to deep dive any of them, you let me know, and we could do a whole
we'll do round two
species.
We absolutely will. And I think sometime after IHS, it'd be good to do another episode so we can kind of talk follow more up about it, and, you know, do mm-hmm. those things and talk about what's next. You know,
yeah. Sounds nice. So, all right. So if you need to get a hold of Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If you need to get a hold of me, Dr. Crawdad at Instagram, Zach Loafman on Facebook, and then Z Loafman, Loughman at westliberty.edu. That's where I can be found. Like I said, we've got the falsies, so ask about that. A couple people have asked about the book. Russ and I have actually sold out of our copies of the book, which is that's kind of mind-boggling to me.
That's awesome, but, is what it is.
Well, you can actually get it on Amazon now. And I found that out when somebody said, hey, I got your book. And I thought, okay, I don't remember being part of that sale. And I said, where? And they were like, Amazon. So that's how I found out that my book was on Amazon. So anyway, you can get a softback there if you're interested in. So, you know, hit that up. If people want to get a hold of you, Clint, where can they find you?
You can reach me on Facebook, Clint Bartley, or the Metazotics Facebook page. Follow that because we have a lot of fun there typically. It's good stuff. Mm-hmm. You can email me at metazotics@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram at Metazotics LLC. Also, I meant to mention this earlier, please, with ExoTerra supporting the show, follow their socials as well for us.
Yes.
That's at ExoTerra USA, and they're on all the major socials. And of course, you can reach Zach and I both at the Colubrin Clubroid Radio Facebook page. That is a great place for you to message your ideas, show topics, potential talks for Colubrid Fest, and just really any feedback whatsoever. Zach and I both look at that, and we take it all to heart.
Sure do. Yep, and I want to thank NPR Network for having us. We are proud members of that network. Eric does a wonderful thing for all the herp nerds of the world, giving us all content. So with that being said, whatever time of day, night, evening, morning it is, hope you're having a great one. Later.